Israel was a spreading vine. He brought forth fruit for himself. As his fruit increased, he built more altars. As his land prospered, he adorned his sacred stones. Their heart is deceitful, and now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will demolish their altars and destroy their sacred stones. Then they will say, "We have no king, because we did not revere the Lord." But even if we had a king, what could he do for us? They may make many promises, take false oaths, and make agreements. Therefore, lawsuits spring up, like poisonous weeds in a plowed field. The people who live in Samaria fear for the calf idol of Beth Avon. Its people will mourn over it, and so will its idolatrous priests. Those who had rejoiced over us, over its splendor, because it is taken from them into exile. It will be carried to Assyria as tribute for the great king. Ephraim will be disgraced. Israel will be ashamed of its foreign alliances. Samaria's king will be destroyed, swept away like a twig on the surface of the waters. The high places of wickedness will be destroyed. It is the sin of Israel. Thorns and thistles will grow up and cover their altars. Then they will say to the mountains, "Cover us," and to the hills, "Fall on us."
So Luke chapter 23, beginning at verse 26. As the soldiers led him away, they seized Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country, and put the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. A large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. For the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the childless women, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if people do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry?"
Thanks, Julia, and thanks, Michael. We're going to keep on looking at that passage from Luke's Gospel, so it'd be a great help if you could keep that open in front of you over the next few minutes. And this passage is a little bit of a snapshot. It's kind of a sort of transition moment from within the story of Jesus' last days. And we're going to see it's got some important things to say to us, particularly along the lines of this question here. Why did Jesus die on the cross? It's a really, really important question to figure out. We're dealing with a historically true event. There's no question in historians' mind that a man called Jesus was crucified by the Romans about the year AD 30 or 33 outside Jerusalem. It was a regular occurrence with the Roman occupiers that they would do things like this, and we have these eyewitness reports. So no historians dispute that it happened. But why did it happen? What was going on at that time that led to this death that has become so central to the world as we know it today? By the end of this week, billions of people around the world will be marking the moment of Jesus' death on Good Friday. What is it about that day that so captures our attention? What's the significance of it? Because to be able to answer that question is really to get us into the heart of Christian faith. Now, I know many of us here will have been Christians for some time, and the events of Good Friday will be familiar to us, and its significance will be something that is well known to us. And yet it's good to pause, isn't it, and to think again about just why it was that Jesus was dying on the cross, and why it is called Good Friday. Why is it good that someone should die? So easy to take for granted when we've known about it for a while. So it's a chance this week, beginning with our passage today, to really dig a bit deeper, to freshen up on the good news of Jesus. But perhaps others of us here are less familiar with the answers to this question, why did Jesus die? And I hope what we're going to see from the passage today will help us to think about some of the possible answers to that question. Perhaps some of the answers that are less satisfactory, as well as some that are more satisfactory. And there are some answers that are quite surprising as well, that will get all of us thinking afresh. So why did Jesus die on the cross? We're going to work through the first two quite quickly and then slow down a bit for the third before touching very briefly on a fourth to finish. I think the first reason why Jesus died on the cross, and people often think of this, is that it is a wonderful example. Perhaps you're familiar with where we are in the story of Jesus. We've just had what could only really be described as a sham trial. Jesus has been in front of the religious leaders in Jerusalem, the Roman leaders, Pontius Pilate and Herod, and none of them have got anything really substantial against him, and yet here he is now, condemned to death, being led away by soldiers. So verse 26, as the soldiers led him away, they seized Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country, and put the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. So here's Simon, innocent civilian, just going about his business, coming in from the country. And the Roman soldiers, as is so often through human experience, pick on the foreigner. This man from Cyrene, North Africa, probably Libya as we know it today. And they make him carry the cross, following behind Jesus. And the way Luke tells us this little event that's seemingly inconsequential just makes us think back to some things that Jesus was teaching earlier. Perhaps if you've heard some of Jesus' teaching, you'll know the point where he says, if anyone wants to be my disciple, they must take up their cross and follow me. And so what we have here with Simon is just a little kind of a snapshot of someone, as it were, following Jesus' example, taking up the cross and following behind Jesus. And that's one of the ways that we can see something of the significance of why Jesus died on the cross as a wonderful example. Just like Simon, calling on people to follow in his footsteps, to take up our cross, to follow him, to live with that question ringing in our ears, what would Jesus do? A life of serving others, of loving others, of even self-sacrifice. Jesus' death is a wonderful example, as we see this little glimpse of what Simon got to do, literally taking up the cross and following behind Jesus. It reminds us of the shape of the Christian life, following Jesus. But the thing is, you can be a wonderful example without giving up your life, without dying. We're surrounded by countless examples of true heroes who have served sacrificially without actually going the full distance of giving their life. Perhaps you saw in the week this gentleman, Harry Billinge, who died this week. He was on the news back in 2019. He's a veteran of the World War II D-Day landings and was awarded an MBE in 2019 for the fundraising that he'd been doing for the sake of military veterans. A real hero who didn't give his life in World War II, and yet we rightly recognise him as a wonderful example to follow. Or Captain Tom, can't forget that from a couple of years ago, raising money for the NHS as he walked around the garden and captured a nation's desire to support those who were working so hard to fight the effects of the virus and care for those who were suffering with it. We're not short of inspiring examples of people who were wonderful but didn't give their lives. So Jesus is a wonderful example to us in his death, but that's not really to get to the bottom of why Jesus died on the cross, is it? He could have been a wonderful example without dying. And in fact, his death almost seems like a bit of a pointless tragedy. And actually, that's the next possible reason that it's worth considering when we think about why did Jesus die on the cross. Was it perhaps a tragic accident? An unfortunate turn of events, just in the wrong place at the wrong time. A sort of political miscalculation on Jesus' part. He thought he was being welcomed into Jerusalem, like we read, as king, crowds celebrating him, but then very quickly found himself in trouble with the authorities. Many back then saw it as a tragic accident. So verse 27, if you look down at that with me, a large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. So there's the crowd following him, wondering how it's all going to pan out. It's not looking good for this guy that was being celebrated and acclaimed just a few days earlier. The women realize where it's all heading. They're mourning and wailing. The Middle Eastern culture of the day, and I think it still continues today as well, is one of great expressiveness around grief. So this idea of people publicly wailing and mourning and weeping, very much part of what you'd expect to see at a moment of great sadness and imminent death. So is that what we've got here? We've got a tragic accident, a great teacher caught up in the political crossfire between Jews and Romans, an innocent victim of injustice, a man who helped others, and it's all now going so horribly wrong. The helper needs to be helped. I saw in the news this week of quite a remarkable situation where an ambulance was driving along a dual carriageway in Wales, and it had a close encounter with some low-flying swans, which made quite a mess of its windscreen. Now, thankfully, no one was hurt, and the swans were fine. Clearly quite robust creatures to be able to do something like that to a windscreen and come off unharmed. But the ambulance, at the end of the day, needed to be towed away. It wasn't going to be much use for helping anyone with a windscreen like that. It's going to need at least a new windscreen. But the helpers got themselves into trouble and needed to be helped. And is that what we've got going on here with Jesus? He's meant to be there helping, but it's all gone horribly pear-shaped, horribly wrong. Well, no, that's not what Jesus thinks is going on here. Because look how he responds to the weeping and wailing in verse 28. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me." We'll come back to the rest of that verse in a moment. But I just want us to see that Jesus isn't wanting the focus to be on him and what he's facing. It's like he knows what's going on. His sort of calm confidence here. He's not worried about what he's going through because he knows where it's going. He knows that it's no accident. Several times earlier in the Gospel of Luke, we read of him predicting precisely these things were going to happen. So it's not catching him by surprise. It's not that he's just made a big mistake in front of the various councils and courts that he's been in front of and it didn't quite work out as planned. He knows what's going on. There's no need to weep for him. It's not a tragic accident, though it is, of course, tragic the way that he was treated. Shameful, really. The most loving and good man who had ever lived, condemned to die. Jews and non-Jews, all of humanity together, conspiring to execute him. But Jesus, he knows what's happening. Why did Jesus die? Well, it's not a tragic accident. I think we can rule that one out from what we're seeing here, what Jesus is doing and saying. But there's another possible reason here in this story, and we're going to spend a bit longer digging into this one. Why did Jesus die on the cross? Well, it's a dreadful warning. It's a dreadful warning. Do you remember what Jesus said? Don't weep for me. And then what does he say in verse 28? Weep for yourselves. Now, we're all, in some ways, familiar with the horror of what Jesus faced in his execution on the cross. The physical brutality, the emotional taunting, the psychological pressure. But Jesus says there's actually something far worse coming. Something that's really worth crying about. Don't weep for me, he says, weep for yourselves. Now, I don't know if you've ever been around small children. I'm sure we've seen it at times. The magical properties of a parent's cuddle. So I'm sure you can picture the scene. You've got a little one toddling around, and they fall over, and they go bump. And they kind of descend into fits of weeping and crying and tears. Heap on the floor, sort of body fluids going everywhere. It's absolutely terrible. It's like the end of the world. But then a parent comes along and kind of scoops them up, gives them a great big hug, wipes their tears away, kisses them better, and magically, all is well again. Just like that, just a sudden change. Well, Jesus gives a dreadful warning here that it's not going to be that easy. These won't be tears that can just be wiped away with a little cuddle. And I want to unpack this sort of background to this in a couple of stages. Because Jesus is giving this dreadful warning here. And it's something that he's been warning and weeping about already. And I want to rewind us a little bit back through Luke's gospel just to see how this theme in this passage has been developing for some time. Because it's quite easy to miss in amongst all the great stories and the wonderful miracles Jesus has been doing. There's just these few little snippets that give us a clue as to where this event has come from. So let me take you back, first of all, to chapter 13 and verse 34, where Jesus says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you are not willing." So do you see Jesus' love for Jerusalem here? That kind of picture of a hen with her little chicks nestled under her wings. Well, Jesus kind of wants to shelter and care for the people of Jerusalem. He's got a great love for them. And yet, they seem to be set in their self-destructive ways. And then on to chapter 19, just after Jesus has ridden into Jerusalem on the donkey, as we celebrate today on Palm Sunday, Jesus, as he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, "If you, even you, had known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it's hidden from your eyes. The days will come upon you when your enemies build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you." And these were standard military tactics of the first century. Surround the city, starve them out, crush the morale of the population. And Jesus is just highlighting here again the self-destructive ways of the people of Jerusalem, warning them about the invaders who will come and surround them, and the terrible picture of a brutal military defeat for Jerusalem. And then again on into chapter 21, as Jesus is sitting in the temple talking with his disciples, with his friends, he says this: "When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those in the city get out, and let those in the country not enter the city, for this is the time of punishment, in fulfillment of all that has been written. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. There will be great distress in the land and wrath against this people. They will fall by the sword and will be taken as prisoners to all the nations. Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And so this is another of Jesus' warnings in this little theme of the problems coming for Jerusalem. And it's warning of that destruction of Jerusalem that actually took place in AD 70 when the Romans came and surrounded the place. And those who managed to survive the starvation in the siege, most of them were killed by the Romans. Others were taken prisoner and deported. And of course, it's the most vulnerable who come off worse. So back to our passage today where Jesus says, weep for yourselves and for your children. For the time will come when you will say, blessed are the childless women, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed. Because of course it's easier to flee in war when you don't have children, to slay you down without the worry of their fragile lives and their traumatized future. And these are haunting words for us to read as we live at a time when images of Ukraine are flashing across our screens. Atrocities committed against civilians, women, children, maternity wards. War is horrendous. Words almost fail us at this point. That's why we so often turn to poetry in times of crisis. Some of the most profound reflections on World War I and World War II are found in poetry, where words are sort of bursting to capture the emotion of all that's going on, the visceral horror of it all. And so this is just helping us to get into Jesus's dreadful warning in this passage. It's something that he's been warning and weeping about already. But it's also a dreadful warning of something inescapable and terrifying. As we read this passage, we can see that. But just before we get to it, I just sort of want to put a picture in your mind of perhaps a happier kind of situation, of hide and seek. I'm sure we've all seen, we've seen the toddlers who kind of are able to hide by just kind of closing their eyes and lurking behind something like this that doesn't really hide them. But the slightly older children, the sort of round after round of little children squeezing themselves into new nooks and crannies. Our children were out with the neighbours yesterday afternoon, who've just recently moved in, getting the chance to hide in a new garden. Such an exciting moment when you can find new hiding places and tucking themselves into places, whether it's behind a shed or into a cupboard or under a curtain or a blanket, sort of smothering the giggles so that they don't get themselves found, trying to contain their delight in a new hideaway, all the while hoping not to be found. Well, it's a bit like there's another game of hide and seek going on in the passage here in verse 30 and 31, but the stakes are far higher. Verse 30, they will say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if people do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it's dry? It's like they're trying to hide under the mountains, escaping from the dreadful terror of the city, all the while hoping they won't be found. It really is a dreadful warning that Jesus is sounding here, something inescapable and terrifying. Because, of course, the hills won't oblige and cover them up. It's going to be worse than what happened to Jesus. He's that sort of green wood that he talks about in that slightly enigmatic proverb at the end. This solitary figure being tortured and executed by the Romans, Jesus, that green wood, freshly cut, won't burn quickly. But in the future, when the wood's had a chance to dry, Well, what happens when you light dry wood? What's it going to be like when that flame arrives? It's going to be a fiery inferno. Jesus is warning of much worse to come than what they're experiencing on this day, the first Good Friday. It's a dreadful warning of worse to come. So why did Jesus die? It is a dreadful warning. Yes, the crucifixion is bad, but there's worse to come. The fall of Jerusalem, but actually the fall of Jerusalem, bad as it was, is a small snapshot. It's an image of what is coming on the last day. The very same imagery is used of the coming of God's judgment. We see it in the book of Hosea, which we read earlier, the judgment of God coming, a dreadful day. And Jesus says, weep, weep over that. Weep over what's coming your way, people of Jerusalem. Weep at that day of judgment that's coming. But is that it from this passage? I mean, it seems a bit of a bleak note to leave things on. Hopeless, dark, gloomy. Well, of course, the story continues, and we will be digging more into that later today at the 5 o'clock service and on through the rest of this week with our services then as well. But I think there is, even in this passage here, just the hints of better news to come. I think it starts when Jesus says, "Don't weep for me." It's a funny thing to say for a man heading to his own death, isn't it? He's about to die in agony and shame on the cross. I mean, why not weep for him? It seems awful what he's facing. And it's here we come back to that bigger sense of purpose. The fact that it wasn't a tragic accident. There's a bigger purpose to it. He's dying to save his people from that terrible judgment that we've just traced through Luke's gospel that is seen throughout the Bible. And Jesus is going to do that by taking that judgment for them. I suppose if you wanted a pithy way of summarizing it, we'd say, why did Jesus die on the cross? Well, he was a saving substitute. He was dying to rescue and protect people from that dreadful judgment that we've just been thinking about. He goes through hell so that we don't have to spare us the fear and terror of that dreadful day. He suffers the horrors of judgment and death so that we, though we deserve nothing of the sort, can have hope and life. It is marvelous. That's the good news of Good Friday, of Easter. And so as we approach Holy Week, we do well to listen to Jesus. That these are his last words to the crowds as he prepares for his death. And what does Jesus tell us? Well, he tells us not to weep over him. Yes, he's going through horrible things, but he doesn't want us weeping over that. He points us in a different kind of direction, a different kind of weeping, really. I mean, weeping is an appropriate response to the events of Good Friday and the death of Jesus. But it's the kind of weeping, I think it's the kind of weeping that recognizes what we really deserve. We weep over our sin. I think that's what Jesus was saying to the women who were weeping and wailing, inviting them not to weep for him, but for themselves, for their own predicament, for their own sin that was leading to judgment. And that's the kind of weeping that listens to that dreadful warning in Jesus' death, that then takes refuge in Jesus, the saving substitute, to protect us from the judgment that we deserve. He is our substitute. That's why he died. And so I think this passage asks of each one of us the question, have you done that? Have you wept over your sin and all that it deserves? Have we turned to Jesus to find hope and life? Because that's the kind of weeping that Jesus wants. Now, perhaps weeping feels a bit culturally alien to us. Many of us in sort of British culture aren't used to kind of public displays of emotion. But I think what Jesus is getting at here is a sense of deep sorrow, regret, despair even, over what we have done. Now, I'm speaking today to many who are familiar with the ideas of sin, of Jesus' death on the cross as our substitute. And certainly as I've been looking at this passage this week, it's challenged me to think, am I taking for granted, am I not taking seriously what Jesus has actually done, what he's spared me from, and just how serious my sin was and is, that he should have to go through this for me, and that the alternative should be so dreadful. Not just fake tears, but real sorrow over our failures and rebellion. So there's a call here from Jesus to weep over our sin. And then I think there's also a second kind of weeping as well, a weeping over others. A weeping for those who are not yet safe in Jesus, just like he wept over Jerusalem, longing to see her people safe and peaceful. It's a kind of weeping that turns into praying. And a kind of praying that turns into inviting, speaking. Inviting that turns into hearing, a hearing that turns into believing. A believing that finds safety in Jesus as the only way out of this dreadful warning, this dreadful judgment that the world faces. And I don't know about you, but I sometimes get that kind of sense of compassion fatigue. You know, you've kind of been, I mean, you see it in humanitarian situations, don't you, where you've been seeing dreadful images on the TV week after week, month after month, and you begin to feel slightly less raw over what you're seeing because you're just kind of getting compassion fatigue. It's not kind of impacting you in the same way. And I think that can happen to us in our outlook on others as well. As we live amongst others who don't know Jesus, we can get that sense of compassion fatigue, that we forget just how dreadful the world is, the future is, without the hope and life that can be found in Jesus, without God's love. And we forget what a wonderful gift we have to share with people in Jesus and his death. And we get that kind of compassion fatigue. It stops getting to us, the fact that some people don't know this love, the fact that some people don't know this hope, the fact that some people still face a dreadful judgment. And so perhaps this day, this Easter, the Lord is wanting to lay on our hearts afresh others who don't yet know the reason why Jesus died, the difference it can make in life and death. He's calling us again to weep for those who don't know Jesus. Because Jesus died to be our saving substitute, to save us, to bring us safely through that dreadful judgment. He's our only hope in life and death. Nothing else can save us. Now, what amazing love that he should die for me, for you, for people who frankly don't deserve it. But that's exactly what he did on that cross 2,000 years ago, so that we can know the love, the peace, the forgiveness, the hope that can only come through his death.